Today, I'm welcoming on to Radio Gorgeous a biographer, art historian, and author of the uber glamorous best-selling Maestra series. She's been reviewing for the Times Literary Supplement for over 20 years. She lives most of her time in Venice, and she is author Lisa Hilton, and she's written a very exciting book called Sex and the City of Ladies. Hi, welcome back to Radio Gorgeous, Lisa.
Hello, it's lovely to be with you again.
Absolute pleasure. So tell us about Sex and the City of Ladies. It sounds so provocative.
Well, despite having sex in the title, it's very different from the last book I came on Radio Gorgeous to discuss, which was the novel you just mentioned, Maestra. This is very much a return to doing history books. The City of Ladies, to which it refers, is actually a reference to a book by Christine de Pizan, who is the first known professional female writer in the Western world, the first woman to make her living by her pen. And in 1405, she wrote a book called The Book of the City of Ladies, which was essentially an attack on the misogynistic patriarchal culture of the time. And what Christine suggested in the book, by looking at the biographies of hundreds of women, some of them well-known, some of them saints, but some of them much lesser figures from history, was that women were just as worthy, as intellectually capable, and as spiritually profound as men. And what this book does is it updates Christine's idea in the same form, the dream vision that her book takes, but with dialogue with three very well-known historical women, Cleopatra, Catherine the Great, and Lucrezia Borgia.
Amazing. So you wrote this, but and you became her, and you in the story, in the book, I mean, it is factual, but obviously there's a little bit of fiction in the way that you have a dream and you meet them and you have a chat.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's a technique that's very popular in medieval literature, the dream vision. Chaucer is one example who uses it quite a lot. Obviously, using it in a modern day context was a bit tongue in cheek. It's kind of gone out of fashion in terms of style, but it was quite a good way to identify with Christine and also to allow for a little bit of playfulness and silliness in the book, in that each of these women is such a monumental character, and the book's not intended to be in any way a comprehensive scholarly biography of any of them. What it is a way of using the lives of these very well-known women to look at the way in which we think about women in history, the way about which we write about women in history, in a bit of a different fashion.
Because they've been portrayed as you say, as sort of sexual objects who use their sex power, and everything was the male writers that have written about it, it's all sex is always a reference to their personality.
Absolutely. There's a degree to which all three of these women have their reputations, their achievements have been overshadowed by their sexuality. But there's something more in that. This isn't about a book about rehabilitating women. I mean, a great deal of fantastic feminist history has taken place in the last 50 years, which is about revoicing women, re-establishing, reconsidering women's reputations. And that's not really what I'm trying to do here. What I'm really trying to attempt is, I suppose, a question of the way we think about history, because we always think of women as other. You're not a writer, you're a woman writer. You're not a ruler, you're a woman ruler. And whilst there's a lot to be said for that approach, I still think it casts women as other, as different, as somehow inherently problematic. And one of the ways in which this happened is through the emphasis on sex. If you think of the way that great men's lives are written, their sex lives, their emotional lives are a separate thing. They may be relevant, but they're certainly not the whole picture. Where in the case of women, it's always about the emotional, it's about the body. It's as though women in history can't ever escape from their own corporeality. And that's why it was quite fun to play with the idea of these three women as being ghosts who finally got rid of their bodies and want to do something about their reputations.
So tell us about each individual one. Tell us about Cleopatra first.
Well, I mean, Cleopatra probably is maybe the most famous woman in the world. She's obviously known all over the world. And when we think of her, we think of glamour, we think of exoticism, we think of Elizabeth Taylor, we think of Katy Perry. What we don't think of is a 17-year-old woman who became queen of the most ancient civilization in the world and who held her nation together in the face of the most brutal war the world had ever seen, launched by its biggest empire, a situation which pertained for 20 years. When we think of Cleopatra, we think of the lovers, we think of Julius Caesar, we think of Mark Antony, we think of, you know, the famous carpet story. What we don't think about is a woman who is intensely sophisticated, well-educated, who established herself as a living goddess, and who managed to rule alone at an extremely difficult time in the political history of her country. Cleopatra's achievements were enormous. They're not very widely documented. There's actually a remarkably scant amount of genuine historical sources about Cleopatra. But what's interesting about her is that out of these sources has grown a huge legend, and yet the legend overshadows the real achievements of the life. So that's Cleopatra. Lucrezia Borgia, obviously, we think of the Borgias. What do we think of? We think of incest and we think of poison. But Lucrezia was as much a victim of her family circumstances as she was a villain. She was the daughter of the Borgia Pope, Alexander VI, the sister of Cesare Borgia, one of the greatest generals and possibly wickedest rulers of Renaissance Europe. And for much of her life, she was used as a pawn by the men in her family. She was married off to various different men, divorced at random, separated from her children. But nonetheless, she, in her last years, when she was Duchess of Ferrara, managed to carve out an interesting, authoritative and meaningful life for herself. She was a pioneer of women's education. She was a pioneer of various religious houses. She was greatly loved and respected, and she was competent enough as a ruler to be left in charge of the town of Spoleto and also to have the keys to the Vatican papers when her father was away, which is again an extraordinary achievement for a woman at a time. And then Catherine the Great, and I think this is the most pertinent example of what I'm talking about when we still feel the need to put woman in front of something as a qualifier. The most interesting thing about Catherine the Great was not that she was a woman. It was that she was Empress of all the Russias. She had an autocratic power which even the most, you know, vicious modern dictator couldn't possibly dream. And yet, like Lucrezia and to an extent like Cleopatra, she was not only an amazing politician, but she achieved a great deal in terms of culture and education. She opened the first school for women in Russia. She oversaw the continuing of the Russian Cultural Enlightenment. And she was also really good fun, I think, which again, one rarely sees the personality in these sort of legendary figures. But reading Catherine's correspondence, which is in French, as I did for this book, I really had a sense of her as a person. And so the dialogue is between these three women, and they're quite sort of snappy. I mean, they're not necessarily admiring of one another, and they make jokes at each other's expense. But they're unified in a desire, as they say, to retire from history and settle down somewhere more comfortable. Cleopatra dreams about slipping into a nice comfy caftan, and Catherine fancies a game of billiards after dinner, whereas Lucrezia is looking forward to having a nice little garden in which she can grow her various herbs.
Fabulous. I love it. So how much fun was it writing this book? It sounds great.
It was quite a scary book to write. I mean, it's a little tiny book. It's a quick read. It was a commission from the TLS. I was quite daunted by taking on three such monumental women and having to condense their lives into such a small space. And as I say, it's not remotely meant to be a comprehensive or scholarly history of any of them. What it was lovely to imagine in this dramatic context of Christine's book, how one could have a conversation with these women, how one could talk to them, and how one could look at what we think of as modern feminism through their eyes. So they talk about themselves as being, you know, victims of the patriarchy, and isn't it time that they were empowered? And they use all the cliches of contemporary feminism, and it's
still really being, which is still, we all still say the same things, isn't that
exactly.
incredible?
Exactly, and it's a way of looking at how much contemporary feminism is actually changing the world, because although feminism is now used to sell us everything from scatter cushions to lipstick to t-shirts, how much has it actually achieved and how far does it have to go? I think there's still a great deal more we can do and a great deal more ways we can think about feminism. And this book is a, as I say, a light-hearted way of investigating that.
Fantastic, Lisa. I'm stuck for words because I think you've really said everything. But yes, lastly, which of the three women would you like to have a coffee with in Piazza San Marco and why?
Oh, well, I probably wouldn't like to have a coffee with Lucrezia Borgia, just in case. I think that might be a bit risky. I'd be tempted to say Catherine, but in a way, she is the most modern of the women. She's the most relatable. And the one I'd have to go for Cleopatra, because she's just so fascinating. And the only difficult thing I think would be, as I sat down at Florin's in Piazza San Marco and ordered my coffee, is how would I recognise her? Because one of the points the book makes is that no one knows what Cleopatra looked like. She's one of the most...
Don't believe it.
That she's one of the most represented women in the world, and yet there's absolutely no evidence of what she actually looked like. We don't know what colour her skin was, we don't know what her hair looked like. There are only a couple of coin portraits which are extant from her lifetime, in which, frankly, she looks like a Roman general. It's not her best look, really. So I think that alone, actually knowing what Cleopatra really looked like, would be extraordinary. Also, she gets to make the best and rudest joke in the book, which I won't repeat for your listeners' ears, but it's a variation on the length of Cleopatra's nose, which was Pascal's theory of history.
I think in a way maybe it's refreshing that we don't know what she looks like, because think about every woman in history or in politics now or in any business, it's always about how they look.
It is, and that's something I think is extraordinary, that we still talk about women's appearance, women's clothes, what their legs are like, what their hair's like, as though that's remotely relevant. I mean, if you think about the last American election, you know, people were making comments about Hillary Clinton's pantsuits, not her policies. And it's something which it seems so basic, and yet women are still subjected to it in a way that men simply are not. And similarly, when we look at historical women, it's a way of reducing them, is to comment on their appearance as though that's the most significant thing about them. And a good example, for example, would be Elizabeth I and her quarrel with Mary, Queen of Scots, which, despite the fact that Mary was in effect the head of a terrorist faction which threatened not only Elizabeth's life but her state, the idea is that Elizabeth executed her because she was jealous, because Mary was prettier. And we still live with these absurdities all the time, and we've kind of absorbed them, we take them for granted. And so what I was trying to do with Sex and the City of Ladies is to use a medieval feminist book to show up quite how little progress, in some ways, women have made.
Exactly. I think it's going to be an it's always going to be a fight, I think, for the rest of time, to be honest. You know, just biologically, because we generally, not always, but usually have the child. It's the moment I became a feminist. As soon as I had a child, I realised I can't leave the house unless I have the child with me. Whereas the man or the partner, male or female, can just walk out of the house.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's something that all three women had in common as well, Cleopatra, Lucrezia and Catherine, is that they all had to sacrifice, in a sense, their relationships with their children. And yet they were immensely protective of and ambitious for them. So I suppose, although it's anachronistic to say that they were feminists, I think one can certainly sympathise with them as women, as sisters.
Fantastic. So Sex and the City of Ladies is published by TLS. Thank you so much, Lisa, for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you. And go out and buy it, everybody.